Humanities Foundation of West Virginia, a state agency for the disbursement of funds by the National Endowment for the Humanities in Washington, D.C. And this support and the requirements for obtaining it have forced us to look in a new way at what we do here at Augusta. We can come here and attend classes and learn to make baskets, or learn to sing ballads, or learn to dance, or study folklore, and never really look at the humanities issues involved in what we're doing. As Chuck Daugherty, the state director, likes to point out, there's a lot of confusion sometimes between humanities and humanitarian, or a humanist and a humanitarian. There's no relationship between those two things at all. And Chuck gave me this little pamphlet describing what the humanities is, and I thought, we've been talking all summer from one week to the next in these panels about the humanities issues underlying what we do here, but we've never really taken a hard look at what the humanities is, or what the humanities people think the humanities is. So I want to read just a little from this definition that Chuck gave me, entitled The Humanities in America. Nailed to the ship's mast in Moby Dick is a gold doubloon stamped with signs and symbols in luxuriant profusion. The coin is Captain Ahab's promised reward to the crewman who sights the white whale. But in its emblems, each man reads his own meaning. As Ahab says, this round gold is but the image of the rounder globe, which, like a magician's glass, to each and every man in turn, but mirrors back his own mysterious self. Like the bright doubloon, the humanities mirror our own image and our image of the world. Through the humanities, we reflect on the fundamental question, what does it mean to be human? The humanities offer clues, but never a complete answer. They reveal how people have tried to make moral, spiritual, and intellectual sense of a world in which irrationality, despair, loneliness, and death are as conspicuous as birth, friendship, hope, and reason. We learn how individuals or societies define the moral life and try to attain it, and attempt to reconcile freedom and the responsibilities of citizenship, and express themselves artistically. The humanities do not necessarily mean humanness, nor do they always inspire the individual with what Cicero called incentives to noble action, but by awakening a sense of what it might be like to be someone else, or to live in another time or culture, they tell us about ourselves, stretch our imagination, and enrich our experience. They increase our distinctively human potential. And this goes on, talking in different ways about further defining that, but I think that's enough maybe to launch us into this discussion tonight. Can you all, in the interest of making a good recording, sort of squeeze over here a little tighter? Maybe so, yeah. That's good. We've got birds up the chimney now.
Right. Here, I'll let Melvin, you sit here. I hate to sit beside Melvin, but I will.
You're right to sit down what I'm playing on.
But we have the pleasure this evening of getting to share some time with Dwight Diller, who's our banjo instructor for how many years now, Dwight? Since the beginning of it? Or
I came here in 1975, and then 81, 82, 83, and this year.
So Dwight goes way back, and won't be long till there's second. You have second generation students coming to you, right?
Jerry's a lot older than me.
They may have a second generation teacher.
That's true too.
Jerry's a lot older than me.
And we have also with us tonight Melvin Wine from Braxton County, fiddle player, farmer, father, coal miner, an all-around good fellow. And he's been up here with us today. He played some of the best music people have ever heard, and shared all kinds of good tales with us. And through that music that Melvin plays, I always think that I get a glimpse of another time. That old time style of playing and all the stories that Melvin tells that go with that really are for me a glimpse into a sense of what people used to think was important, a sense of how they spent their time, a sense of people who would jump up on tie piles and dance and sing and carry on like your uncle did, things that people don't seem to do anymore. And also with us tonight is Jerry Milnes, a farmer, a father, a surveyor, a surveyor's assistant, a good carpenter, a fiddle player, a banjo picker, all around good fellow too. He's with us. He's been teaching fiddle. This is your third week this summer. And this is what you've taken on this week is a new kind of a class. It's called a fiddle seminar. And I think more than any previous class we've had here, it's an attempt to look at these things we want to try to talk about a little bit tonight. Dwight, maybe we could start with you, and if you could just tell us a little bit about when you first started noticing old-time music, what you think is important about it, what you like about it.
Well, that's a long story.
That's okay, let it rip.
I grew up in Pocahontas County, about 60 miles south of here. And for you banjo students of mine, I'm sorry you have to hear this again. grew up about 60 miles south of here, was raised by the generation who was trying to leave this music behind, trying to better themselves. And to better yourself meant to leave a lot of the old ways. My mother and aunts and uncles that raised me grew up in the mountains, mountain people, lived off the land, basically. They had no other income. And so they were trying to better their life. And part of that meant leaving behind outside toilets, old time music. It was all kind of tied in together. I didn't mean for that to come out like that. But it is all tied in together. Especially when Mike plays it. You asked me to get up here and talk. You said, let it rip.
Let it rip. I'll take it like a man.
All right. You get me in a minute. I always figure people have more fun than anybody. I keep reminding myself that. So, I had a kind of a long run of failures in my life. Couldn't seem to get anything together, and was in college and failed out of college, in the Navy and failed out of the Navy, and just on and on and on. Came back out of the Navy in 68, and I was looking for an alternative. There was a lot of other people along 67 who became known as hippies. They were looking for an alternative. My generation was looking for that. I did not go the way they went. I was too radical, too much of a nonconformist to ever be part of that group. And I ended up seeking out the old people in the mountains, people that were my neighbors and I didn't know them, people that the local people in the area looked down on, maybe even sometimes saw them as trash. They were just mountain people that didn't fit in. And so there was a lot pushing against me to not fool with this music. I'll never know what drove me in the music. You know, why keep fooling with it? I just liked it. Part of it was I was extremely desperate at the time. It was either find something like that or kill myself. And I found it. It was the music. And it was a dream world. I lived in a dream world with it for quite a while, with the old people and the old ways, and kind of just went back in time to a time that seemed not quite so confused. And then, of course, when you deal in that kind of reality, that dream world, you either get lost there or you come out of it back to reality of life and see the people that they're not on pedestals. They're just normal, average people like everybody else. Weaknesses and strengths, and the music has strong points, weak points, whatever. And so after a few years, then I had to come out of that reality in order to move on with my life. And it kind of slaps you in the face sometimes. It's like a relationship between a student and his mentor. In order for that student to go on, generally the mentor and the student end up splitting up for a while and then come back together. That's basically what happened to me. I guess if you're asking me the question, I got to push it on a little farther. I pushed the music as far as I could, and it started wearing out. It's deep, but it's not deep enough. And as I pushed it farther and farther and farther, it really started wearing out. So I had to start looking someplace else. And that's when I became a Christian. And I've never left that. I've left the music. I still play it. I still enjoy it. It's a lot of fun. But the only part of the music that has any deep meaning for me is the, those of you who heard the concert the other night, is the certain types of the gospel songs, or the hymns, or the spirituals, or whatever you call that. They have a certain sound. They touch me in a place that I can go on and deal with eternity through those particular songs. I can't through the dance music. There's nothing there. It's nice. It's fun. So you're asking me what the music means to me. The dance music, if I never played another dance tune, I wouldn't care. I enjoy it. I enjoy teaching other people. I'd rather teach as play. And because those people may be in the position that I was. But for me, if I never played another tune, fine. But I always want to sing some hymns, because that's where the depth is. That's where I am today.
That's right. You said some real interesting things there, Dwight. You talked about two worlds. At one point, the dream world that the music took you into, that, and then coming back to the real world, the dream world of the old people and so on. I thought that was interesting. I'd like to get back to that. Melvin, what's this old music meant to you, anyway?
Well, I've been hit about the same way he has. I was raised up in a family of where we played music. And my dad played. So people come into our home and played, and it was like old time, and I took a hungering for it. So I loved to play, and I did play for years. But I got in a lot in the same category he did. My wife got sick, and some old guy come there that I worked in the coal mines with and prayed for her. And that was a turning place for me. That started the thing up. So,
would you mind standing? I think back here we're not hearing much.
You may have to move up.
Yeah. You can speak into the microphone.
The microphone is not. It's not only for recording.
There are a lot of chairs.
You want to move forward? Move on forward, dear.
I don't speak up very plain. I have a boy that's a Sunday school teacher, and I told my wife, I said, he'd be a fine speaker if he'd just a little louder. Well, she said, you have the same problem. So.
You were saying that your wife got sick and somebody came.
The fellow I worked in the coal mines with, he always talked to me about the Lord and everything that happened, you know. I just couldn't get it. I'd never been to Sunday school, and I'd never been to church, and I didn't know a thing in the world what he was trying to tell me, you know. But when she got sick, why, she wanted him to come pray for her. She had never seen him or didn't know him, but through me talking to her, she wanted him to come. So he came, and he stayed there and talked to her, and we taken her to the hospital. She was in the hospital for 31 days. Well, when she got back home, things had changed a lot, you know. Just, we hadn't accepted the Lord. And they got a revival going in our church. And so she did. And I was one of these fellas, I thought I was a double-minded fellow, and I thought that couldn't happen to me, you know. And I still worked in the coal mines, not with this fellow, though. Well, it just bothered me all the time about it. The more I thought about it, the more I wanted to think about it. So, and one night, he comes to the church, and when he passed by, it just seemed like there's a drawing power there that I had to go, you know. So I went to the altar. That time on, I quit playing the fiddle, and I didn't play none for 20 years. Very little. So we got a grandchild to keep, and I got to playing for her to keep her quiet, you know. My wife was in, she was in 4-H activities, you know. She had to be out and going, so I was babysitting. This little girl, she was only 10 days old when we got her. So she'd cry, and I'd get the fiddle to play for her. And I'd think, well, what about this? This is a gift to me. She liked that, and so did I. So I went right back into playing. Now, I don't care about going and playing a square dance, and I'll tell you the why. When we screwed up, people had it in for one another. They went to a square dance to have it out. They fought, they everything like that. So I just have a... It's not that it would hurt me, but if some old person that I was raised with had seen me out playing for a square dance, it might bother them. Paul said, if it hurts them for the meat to meet, he wouldn't eat it, you know. So I just don't play for square dances. I'll play a little to get them started or something like that for people or something like that, just for fun. But if we're going out and playing much for square dances, I don't do it. On that reason, it ain't that I don't think it. I don't see a thing wrong with the people anymore, much of playing or dancing or having dances, because it's not carried on like it was when I was a kid. It was drinking and it was fighting and all kinds of bad language and things like that. So therefore, I have somewhat against it in that way. So I don't go and play for them, very little of any. I'll just go up to our neighbors or somewhere, maybe they're doing something like that. But as far as going out and playing for dances, I just don't. And besides, it tires me out anymore. When I used to play a lot, I played for maybe for 6 days and nights around these fairs and for the dancing. And he'd just give me arthritis, and then I worked in the coal mines, and that bothers me now today to play very long. I played more this evening. I played for a long time, but just because people like it. That's the reason I play, because it's enjoyment to people. I've been a lot of places and played. They come down here and call me in from here to Seattle, Washington, and went up there and played, and I taught a class up there for a week. And real nice up there. People nice up there. And anywhere like that I go and I play for people. My wife don't care too much about me going. She ain't got nothing against the music, but she just don't care where me going. She had a stroke a year and a half ago. And I've been tied to the house, you know. So, music. I played in Washington, D.C. with some fellas that come out of there's from a lot of different states there, but these people had went before the governor and they'd got to trying to get the old music reborn. Now, my father played a fiddle, and I don't try to change. I have a few times think I ought to just get out and, you know, play more up to date and more music like that. Then I think, what is it? The old music's what I'm after, so I just stay with it. Play the old time way, and I stay with that the whole time. So music, I like music. My family plays music. My kids sing, and some of them plays with me. But they're good. Good, they sing good church songs. I'm Sunday school superintendent, and so that's the way it's been. I have been for 30 years. I've only been off 2 years out of 30 years. So I'm there pretty near every Sunday. When I go out to play somewhere, if there's any chance for me to leave and get back home, I tell the people where I'm playing what I need to do. So,
those old tunes remind you of the old days?
Yes, they do. Yeah, sure.
What was it about the old days that you liked so much, or that you like to remember so much?
Well, people gather in the evening and they'd play. You pitch horseshoe. That was the pastime then. And you pitch horseshoe and you play music, and it was real nice. Go from home to home. We'd go from home to home and we'd sing and play music till midnight. Yeah, real nice. Good communication in a community. Anymore, I went out to Romney, West Virginia, to get a load of peaches. I used to haul fruit from there through Braxton County. An old fellow sitting over on the stool, and he said, "Come over here." I went over and went to talking to him, and he said, "The people of this country are starving to death for fellowship." That's the reason. That's one of the reasons for these gatherings, I believe it is, for people to get together and listen to the music and talk and be friendly. That's the reason we have our wine reunion. We had one Sunday. There's a lot of people there. And we played a lot and sung a lot. And so I'll tell you, when the children of Israel laid down their harps, they're in bad shape.
Do you think this old-time music is faring pretty well?
It's rekindling. I think it is, yeah. Yes, I really do. A lot of people are trying to get back. One fella come to me down at Glenville at the old folks' festival, and he said, "You need somebody to take and follow you right, just like you play, and keep them under you." Because, he said, "There ain't nobody plays like you." And I don't know whether he's right or not, but I don't hear nobody play like me. Jerry plays a lot like me. Jerry learned a lot of tunes from me, and he plays a lot of my tunes, and he plays them well. So that's what I'm. That's the reason I go play for people, because they love it, and I love to play for people that like it. And I don't interfere with my church business. I go and I take care of my church just the same. I play in the church sometimes. I play a lot of hymns in the church. But we used to go to have a tent meetings, and we'd go out to them as camp meetings. And I play a lot in them, and I tell you, we had some. We had 370 people saved in one revival. It lasted 10 weeks, though. Nobody got tired. Nobody seemed to get hungry.
Speaking of which, if you look around the room, you can see Eleanor Dickinson's display. It goes around onto the windows over there beside you some of the art, the folk art associated with revivalism and in the mountains that she's been studying for years. These religious things are important.
You're right. When I got a change, it was just like turning right square around, huh? Because the things I had done, like drinking and cussing and things like that, I didn't want to do, huh? I wanted to do something different. I wanted to see people saved. I wanted to see them find the Lord. And you never know. You'll never know till it happens to you what joy you get from it. And you don't have to be all the time with somebody else, because he can be with you, you see. Well, I've been in the coal mines and working and just blow my light out and sit in there and enjoy. Huh? This fellow's done found the way.
I like enjoy. A vision of Christianity that includes the fiddle. I don't mind telling you. Jerry, can we hear from you? And then we'll open it up and everybody can ask questions. How come you fool with this old music?
I guess I was thinking about who my friends are these days, and when I think about that, a whole lot of the people who are my friends are people from the older generation. When I'm at home and I want to go and see somebody and talk to somebody, it usually means I go and look up somebody who doesn't necessarily play music, but a lot of times the person plays music. And I got to thinking about that the other day, and I wonder why that was. And I guess it's the people that I'm attracted to, and people like Melvin and other folks who don't necessarily have to play music, but I was thinking about what it is about these people that, why am I attracted to them? And I guess it's, I've lived in a lot of different places. I've never lived in big cities, but I lived in suburban areas and met all kinds of people. And I've lived up and down the East Coast a little bit. And I've lived in West Virginia for the last 10 years and got to be good friends with Melvin and others like him. And I guess the main thing about these folks and why these kinds of folks have become my friends is that there's nothing phony about them. They're not phony people. There's nothing at all phony about Melvin Wine. He talks from someplace deep inside, and he plays his music from someplace deep inside. And he's had a background that was real down to earth. There's nothing, everything he got, he got the hard way. And I find that this is true of lots of people from his generation, the sort of people that I've seem to be attracted to. So a combination of those sorts of people and the kind of music that I like draws me to that music and that whole old time way of living and everything that these people represent.
I think most of us who've spent any time playing music here in West Virginia would probably agree that there is a special group of tunes that are played here, and they're played in a way that you wouldn't find them played in other places. In other words, there is something very special about the music right in this area. And have you noticed that, Melvin, traveling around?
Yeah, I really have. There's a difference in most of the pitch of the music that goes a lot more than here, a lot of other places. I played for people, they call in. When I played up to Washington, they had people in there from a lot of different states. And I'd play a tune, and then one of the other people from another state would play, like Arkansas or somewhere. They'd play the same tune. Well, it wouldn't, just wasn't it. Maybe mine wasn't it to them, but anyhow, that's just the way it was. So they just wanted to get them together, different sections of the country, and find the difference from the different sections of how the tunes went. Same tune, but be so much different. I like the old West Virginia style.
What about it, Dwight? Is there a different kind of music? We're talking about, well, Randolph will be included in these counties, I think. Certainly Pocahontas and Webster and Braxton.
Clay.
Clay and Gilmer.
Yeah.
And a little bit of Lewis County, maybe.
There's just been a lot of those fiddlers that I've run into over the years. The Hammondses, and as Jerry's saying, when I met the Hammondses, they dealt with me just as straight as an arrow. I just met them, and I put them on a pedestal for a while. That was my problem. And then somehow things got worked out, and for 12, 13 years, those people have been my friends. And I don't feel any age difference. They don't treat me. There was, between Lee Hammonds and I, well, Lee Hammonds was born in 1885, and I was born in 1946, and he and I ran around together, and we didn't feel any age difference between us. I mean, just, he treated me as an equal. He made me feel like that I was somebody. And that was very important to me. There wasn't any talking down to me and patronizing kind of thing. And as I think back over the people that I've known like that, whether they did play music or not, most of the ones I was around did, but they've all treated me that way. And it taught me a lot of lessons about that. I didn't learn them very well because I've been guilty of that patronizing and talking down to people, but they sure didn't treat me that way. I think of Lee Triplett. There was a fiddler that got very little recognition out in the world outside of West Virginia. I'm really sorry that he wasn't on record. I'm real sorry about that. He was a really good fiddler and a fine, fine person.
We have a lot of musical heroes in this state, that's for sure.
Yeah.
These old musicians have really meant a lot to people, and
they're my heroes. Not first because of the music, but first because of who they are. Secondly, because they were really good musicians. But first of all, because of the kind of people they were, and still are the ones who live in.
What has made this West Virginia music different than other places, you think, Jerry?
Well, to me, it has a feeling of its own. I think, as Melvin said a minute ago, if it's the soul of the music or whatever you want to call it that grabs you, I can hear that same kind of thing in other musics from other cultures or from other geographical areas or whatever. But there is a distinct sound that I hear in the music from the area you're talking about. I don't put it above or below any other kind of music. Good music to me is good music, whether it comes from here or there. If it's all got its own special feeling to it. I've always been particularly attracted to the kind of music we've been talking about here from this particular area. So that's the kind of music, I guess, that strikes me the hardest.
What is the relation? Is there a relationship between the music and the place, do you think? And what, if so, can you talk about what it is?
Well, I've always had that feeling, and just the kind of makeup of the country here. It's rough country. It's got a third dimension to it, in that it's got an up and down and a this and this, and the music seems to kind of relate to that feeling. You know, it's got another whole dimension to it when in the feeling of the music and the dimensions of the terrain.
For me, it's a lonely. It's not the kind of loneliness that you feel in a crowd of 1,000 people and you're alone, but it's the kind of loneliness that, I don't know, it kind of makes the skin crawl up and down your spine, that you're out there on top of the mountain. And the wind, I don't know quite how to explain it. It's subjective, and if it strikes you, it's there. For me, Primitive Baptist harmonies or some of the harmonies they have in bluegrass style music, it's like it, 1-1 suddenly equals 3, and it screams in such a way, or I guess screams is not the word, but it's like the wind hitting the pines, those spruce up on top of Black Mountain or whatever. It's, I don't want to try to paint some some great picture, but that's kind of what's in a lot of these tunes. That's why I like them better than anything, any other kind of instrumental music that I've ever heard. It speaks of a wide open kind of loneliness.
I always thought that the in all different kinds of cultural music, for some reason, the people who play it best, or the people who really have it in their grasp, are have come through some hard times. It seems like whether it be Irish music or black music or mountain music, the people who really play it well and express it well are people who've been through hard times, and I don't know why that is.
Are there questions? Yeah, from out in the room. Margo.
Michael, I know you and Jerry have been dealing with the notion of some connection between the Indians who lived in this area and the mountain music that was found in this area. Have you done any more exploring of that, or would you maybe say a little bit about that?
Well, it's not something we really set out to explore so much as it's something that's just come up in conversations with people. You talk to somebody like Sarah Singleton or Ernie Carpenter, and you won't talk to them very long before you start hearing about their Indian forebears. And in Ernie's case, it came out in conversation one time that his some of his forebears had learned to play Indian airs on the fiddle, Indian tunes. Which, when you stop and think about it, really isn't so very surprising, since some of his forebears were themselves Indians. But what surprised me was that there was Indian music that could be played on a fiddle, because I never heard of that in taking history courses. But again and again it comes up, and again and again in this fiddle music, a lot of it you hear. There are attitudes about the music, it seems to me, which are kind of non-Western. The sense of time, the notes that you find in sung music, that at first might sound to you like a sour note if you haven't listened to a lot of, for example, a lot of old regular Baptist singing in Eastern Kentucky. You think, my gosh, those people hit a lot of sour notes. But after the 26th verse of a ballad, you begin to notice that the sour note keeps occurring in the same place in each of the verses, and it isn't really sour at all. It's just a different attitude toward the scale than you've been used to or than you've been raised with. And so these notes, you can only wonder, Margo, where these things came from. It can only be speculation, I think. In the absence of any kind of evidence, but it seems to creep in. People talk about the Indian connection here more than other places that I've been. But then I've been here so long. Maybe if I went somewhere else, people would talk about that too. But you've heard that a lot too all your life, haven't you, Melvin? I suppose.
Yeah.
Do you think there are fiddle tunes that came from the Indian? Do you think that yourself?
Well, a lot of them did. My great grandmother was half Indian, and she sung a lot of those old songs, and my grandfather, he's played a lot of the same ones she sung. So,
what kinds of things did your Indian grandmother sing? Do you remember any of them?
I don't know.
I'm not going to try to corner you into singing them.
No, don't corner me into singing.
I wonder if you can remember the names of any of them. Were they old long ballads or were they religious
songs?
Yeah,
they're old long ballads, most of them. Yeah.
Lord Lovell or Pretty Polly or...
Pretty Polly, yeah. They played that. Little Mo Hee. I used to play that a little on the fiddle. I ain't played it for years. So,
you have Indian blood in you too.
Yeah.
Was that something you always?
I can't do the war dance.
So that, you know, this is how it comes up. And it's kind of a presence, you might say, but I don't know which. I've never heard very much Indian singing. I'm not a scholar of it at all. I don't know. It just seems to me like there's people here in this section of the mountains sing different than they do in other places too.
I wonder if it might be possible, since there might be some people here who are listening to this and hearing some of this for the first time. Hearing about the music is one thing, and hearing some of it might be really illustrative. Maybe some example of a tune that would be typically West Virginian, or a ballad that might have some very definitely crooked or in Indian top overtones.
What do you think? There are three songs that I've heard in West Virginia that are from an Indian point of view. I don't know that any of them were really written by Indians. I don't have any, haven't established the authorship of these songs. One of them I heard from Currence Hammonds. It's called The Poor Little Indian. And the second one from Nellie Pritt, and then from Phyllis Marx, a song called The White Winged Canoe, and the third from Aunt who?
Jenny Wilson.
Aunt Jenny Wilson. We actually learned it out of a book of West Virginia folk songs by Jim Bush. It's called The Steel of the White Man. But then later we heard her sing it over at Ripley, and we were hitting pretty close to it. And then rumors of a fourth song from a woman in Braxton County who learned it in a one-room school about a young Indian woman from her point of view. And... I don't know what kinds of songs like this are turning up in other states, in other sections of the country, but to me, it suggests an empathy with the Indians and identification with them, that these songs have come down through these family repertoires and are still available today. I don't know how many other songs there may have been like that.
Geronimo's Daughter.
Geronimo's Daughter, okay. Could you sing us
I wonder if Bob Butler, sitting over here, he's collected a lot of music out in the Ozarks and Missouri and places. Have you ever run across any Indian stuff, Bob?
I've heard tales of fiddle tunes that had Indian titles and have been unable to get the person to play the fiddle due to arthritic hands to try to remember those tunes. His mother was a full-blooded Cherokee Indian. This is Eminence, Missouri. And he's not very old, he's 56 years old, but he only played one time for me after five repeated visits through that country. He just kept refusing to play. So I've run across some connection with the Indians.
There was a full-blooded Cherokee Indian in Cherokee, North Carolina named Manco Sneed, who just died about a year and a half ago. His repertoire was lots of tunes that obviously had, you know, origins in Ireland or somewhere, but he played some tunes that kind of had that modal sound to them. So who knows?
Give us a Manco Sneed tune. But if any of this is true, or if any of it is even partly true, then it gives an entirely different picture of white-Indian relations.